Welcome once again to our program, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages. This is the 17th in our program. Our guest again is Ron Eldred from John Paul II Catholic High, teaches Bible, apologetics, history. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick Catholic Church at 19th and Poplar. Ron, we've been talking about the tremendous influence that Immanuel Kant has had on philosophy, changing a whole pattern of thinking, and in the process, changing a whole way of looking at the Bible. So let's go on from where we were last time. Contrary to what people may think who've listened to the series for a while, that Kant was a bad person, immoral person, but he had a whole new way that he thought we could come at morality. What is right and wrong? He wouldn't accept the old way of coming at it, and that he had a new way, which of course is very hard for us to accept. Can you say something about his morality, on his belief in God, way based his system of morality on belief in God?
Well, he certainly couldn't base it on that which exists outside of our minds, you know, in the nominal world, in the what we would call the real world, because it might exist, but we can't know it because of the limitations of our senses and things that we've established so far in talking about Kant. But Kant did believe that there was a way, though, that we could know about God, and that's what we're going to be doing here. It has been said that Kant, quote, tore down in order to build up, end of quote. That which he took away in the Critique of Pure Reason, what we spent the last session and a half talking about, he gave back in his book, The Critique of Practical Reason, which he published in 1788. One scholar said of this matter that what he took away at the front door, he let in the back door. That is, he took away a rational proof for God's existence, but was to replace it with experiential or intuitional or emotional or some other such kind of way of his existence. Professor Borey, whom we've quoted several times, in talking about Kant, tells us that practical reason, quote, refers to the making of moral decisions, end of quote. He says that in this book, Kant argues that, quote, everyone has a conscience, a moral law within their souls, not unlike the categories of the Critique of Pure Reason. The moral law he calls the categorical imperative, which means the golden rule, as well as to treat people only as ends, never as means to the end. Remember that in the former critique that we spent a session and a half talking about, the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant suggested that God, freedom, immortality, they're unknowable, whereas, because they exist outside the mind. Whereas in the latter critique, he will mitigate this claim. The 1913 edition of the Catholic Encyclopedia states that the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant, quote, showed that the truths which have always been considered the most important in the whole range of human knowledge have no foundation in metaphysical, that is, purely speculative reasoning. In the Critique of Practical Reason, he aims at showing that these truths rest on a solid moral basis and are thus placed above all speculative contention and the clamor of metaphysical dispute, end of quote. The Encyclopedia goes on to say that, quote, he has overthrown the imposing edifice which Cartesian dogmatism had built on the foundations, I think, that is, I think. He now sets about the task of rebuilding the temple of truth on the foundation, I ought. The moral law is supreme. In point of certainty, it is superior to any deliverance of the purely speculative consciousness. I'm still quoting from the Catechism, or the Encyclopedia. I am more certain that I ought than I am that I am glad, or I am cold, end quote. So instead of starting out as Descartes regarding the beginning point of knowledge to be I think, which we discussed in a whole session. Kant starts out with, I ought, at least in the practical reason. As I said earlier, morality for Kant consists of what is called categorical imperatives, which means that we ought to do our duty, not because it serves our interest or furthers our desires, but for its own sake. Kant published another work entitled Religion Within the Laws or Within the Limits of Reason Alone, in which he argued that religion should be reduced to morality. In other words, do away with all this doctrines and formal churches and sacraments and all that kind of thing.
Teachings of the Bible.
Yes. It should all be reduced to morality, and that every human action should be, as one scholar has written, quote, regulated in such a way that it would be morally profitable for humanity if it were elevated to the status of law. In one sense, this can be seen as a secularization of the golden rule, end of quote.
Wow. Okay. What role did free will play in Kant's philosophy?
Very important. Professor Borges says that in order to have morality, Kant believed we needed free will. If humans are unable to make choices, how could they be held responsible for their action? Also, he proved that we need the idea of immortality, because since justice rarely happens within a lifetime, we need life after death to balance the scales of justice. And this reminds me of the theme of the book of Job, which I'm sure probably most of our listeners are familiar with. However, he concluded that in order for eternal life to exist, or free will, or good and bad for that matter, we need to believe in God. Borey points out that Kant didn't say that God exists, but that, and I'll quote him, although we can never prove the existence of God or immortality or free will or good or bad, we must act as if he and they existed. End of quote. Well, needless to say, some of Kant's ideas were not very popular with many religious thinkers of his day in the late 18th century, and I don't think they're very reassuring in regard to the proof of God's existence either for us today. Certainly not nearly as reassuring as the many arguments that we examined in our series Reasons to Believe, Catholic Apologetics.
So he's really calling everything conscience, by which we know God, immortality, free will, right and wrong?
Yes.
Okay. Since Kant didn't believe that we can know anything for certain, how did he then prove God's existence with certainty?
Well, as we established, Kant taught that since God exists in the nominal realm, he could not be experienced by man. That is, directly. As one scholar has said, quote, he did not entertain the possibility that God could break into the realm of history, the phenomenal realm, and reveal himself, end of quote. Nevertheless, Kant was not an atheist. He did believe that God existed, but denied that we could intellectually know him. Kant believed that although we can't know God using our intelligence, we can know him through our conscience, as you just suggested, and he can be known through the realm of morality. There is a Catholic argument from conscience for proving God's existence developed by John Henry Cardinal Newman and others, and Peter Kreeft and others that I think of. However, Kant was not a religious man in the conventional sense, nor as a philosopher did he claim to be a Christian. A scholar has said that, quote, throughout his adult life, he was never known to utter the name of Jesus Christ, nor would he enter a Christian church, even though he had a Lutheran background, if I recall right. When called upon to attend academic functions, such as graduations and what have you, at the chapel of the University of Königsberg, where he taught, he would march in his academic robes to the door of the chapel, then slip out of line and go home rather than enter the church, end of quote. Although Kant believed in a personal God for whom he was accountable, he totally rejected the ontological arguments for proofs of God's existence of St. Anselm and St. Thomas that we discussed in our series on Catholic apologetics. Recall that in that series we defined ontology as the science of being or existence, And both St. Anselm and St. Thomas had used ontological arguments to prove God's existence. St. Anselm in the 11th century had taught that humans are born with an innate idea of God. Father Robert O'Donnell tells us in his Hooked on Philosophy, Thomas Aquinas Made Easy, that St. Anselm built upon the innate idea of God a very appealing argument for his existence. He started out with the premise that God is the greatest being thinkable and concluded from this his existence. In other words, God is a being so great that one cannot even conceive of a being who would be greater than God. And of course, that being is God. It follows then that God is the greatest thing that one can conceive of, then he must also possess several attributes or perfections, such as omnipotence and simplicity and eternality and others. If he lacked any of these qualities, he would be less than the greatest conceivable being, which is possible. St. Thomas rejected Anselm's reasoning in the 13th century because he believed that, quote, it makes an unjustified leap from what's inside the mind to what is outside the mind, end of quote. St. Thomas posed his own ontological argument for the proof of God's existence, known as the first cause of perfection, which we looked at in that series. But since St. Thomas's day, Father O'Donnell points out that several prominent philosophers have taken St. Anselm's position. For example, we have already considered in earlier sessions of this series René Descartes' theory of innate ideas. And according to Father O'Donnell, Descartes believed that any idea which we have, which is clear and distinct, corresponds to a real thing existing outside the mind. And we do have, he maintained, such a clear and distinct idea of an absolute perfect being. Therefore, God, who is an absolutely perfect being, does exist. Now, we would think that those are not very, you know, strong arguments, you know, to prove God's existence or anything like that. But okay, if you've just about whittled everything else away with your philosophy, you got to grab on to whatever straws, I guess, you can to hang on. And as we discussed in earlier sessions, the problem with Descartes' philosophy is that later philosophers stripped it of all of its religious content. Father O'Donnell says that Immanuel Kant gave Anselm's argument still another twist. Quote, the human intellect cannot know that God exists by manipulating ideas, but we know with certitude that God exists because of the compelling force with which the moral law imposes itself upon our consciousness. What others call conscience, Kant called the categorical imperative. We know that the moral law must be obeyed, and the moral law makes no sense at all unless God exists. Since Kant believed that all beings, including God, exist outside the mind, and nothing outside the mind can be known with certainty, he had to find some way to prove God's existence and all these other things, these religious matters. And according to Father O'Donnell, closer to his own time, Cardinal John Henry Newman found the argument from conscience for proof of God's existence to be most persuasive. Of course, conscience is innate to our being, and we carefully examine Newman's argument for proof of God's existence during our series on Catholic apologetics. You might recall that Newman lived from 1801 to 1890 and was an English convert to the Catholic Church and was made a cardinal by Pope Leo XIII for his valuable contributions to Catholic theology. In fact, some have even called him the father of Vatican II. Father O'Donnell writes that, quote, Newman's profound sense of moral responsibility led him to acknowledge the existence of God as the supreme lawgiver, without whom there could be no moral law. Newman's conscience and Kant's categorical imperative are two sides of the same coin. Conscience focuses on human freedom responding to divine law. The categorical imperative focuses on the divine law commanding human freedom. Such proofs as these relate as much to the human will as to the human intellect, end of quote.
Ron, that's the best explanation I've heard so far of Kant's categorical imperative, and it's the other side of conscience. So thank you, really explained that well. How did Kant then go ahead and prove God's existence?
Well, we've been kind of flirting around with that a little bit. We haven't really put the nail in the coffin, the nail's in the coffin yet. As we suggested a while ago, Kant tied his system of ethics or morality into his proof for God's existence, and he said that goodness is rewarded and evil is punished only if there is a God. Therefore, there is a God. That's one of his little logistic syllogisms there. Another Kantian argument for proof of God's existence goes as follows. We have an obligation to be perfect, but we can only have an obligation to be perfect if we can be perfect. That is, we have the capability of being perfect. And if we can be perfect, and we can be perfect only if God exists, therefore God exists. Well, I think these logical arguments of Kant's for proof of God's existence are rather insipid compared with St. Thomas's powerful arguments. Recall that we examined at least a couple of dozen proofs for God's existence in our series Reasons to Believe Catholic Apologetics, including St. Thomas's Five Ways. In the final analysis, Kant didn't believe that the existence of God, the soul, and ultimate reality could be proved, because proof is based on phenomena and the categories, and these exist inside the mind only. Instead, he thought that we could believe them because they are useful to us. This kind of thinking, I think, opened the door to the philosophy of pragmatism, which is the philosophy that the meaning of ideas or propositions is found in their observable practical consequences. Another way of putting it is, truth is that which works, rather than that which corresponds with reality. And one source says that pragmatists interpret ideas as instruments and plans of action, rather than as images of reality.
That's a profound statement, Ron. Truth is that which works. Oh, I think many of us could easily buy into that. Okay.
Well, it's the dominant philosophy in our society today.
Sure. In the final analysis, how would you rate Kant's role in influencing biblical scholarship, which you've indicated before that was quite profound?
Well, actually, his thought influenced all fields of inquiry, not just theology and biblical scholarship. Political, economic, social, scientific, and religious. Not unlike Descartes, he got everyone thinking, though, in the wrong direction. The Catholic Encyclopedia says in evaluating Kant's influence that many of his opponents, quote, consider that he made a false start when he assumed in his criticism of speculative reason that whatever is universal and necessary in our knowledge must come from the mind itself, and not from the world of reality outside of us, end of quote. Applied to biblical scholarship, this means, of course, that since revelation is found in the world of reality outside of us, that is, in the nomina, that it exists in the Bible, and of course, the Bible exists outside of our minds as well, that it can't be known with any degree of certainty that it is true. If you apply, of course, Kant's way of thinking.
Sure.
The Encyclopedia informs us, the Catholic Encyclopedia informs us, that Kant's philosophy was the starting point for such 19th century German skeptical thinkers as Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, and Schopenhauer, as well as the English agnostics Hamilton and Spencer. They're referring there to Herbert Spencer. Furthermore, he influenced natural scientists such as Laplace, who developed a naturalistic explanation for the origin of the universe by a natural evolution from primitive cosmic nebula. And according to the Encyclopedia, Kant's name is associated with the 19th century Protestant German theologian Albrecht Ritschl. We'll take a look at Ritschl a little bit later on in a later session. And, quote, his method of transforming dogmatic truth into moral inspiration, end of quote. The Encyclopedia goes on to maintain that his ideas, quote, echo in the experiments of Renan and his followers, end of quote. And it's referring, of course, to Ernst Renan, a 19th century French philosopher who is best known for his usually popular book, Vie de Jesus, or The Life of Jesus. We're going to take a little bit of time in one of our sessions and look at Renan. He was a Catholic, I might add, and had a lot of influence on Alfred Loisy and George Tyrell, both Catholic priests in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, who we call modernists, and both of them condemned, their works condemned by the Catholic Church, and both of them excommunicated from the Catholic Church.
And of course, Renan wrote a very popular and appealing Life of Jesus, which of course we would say was really not a good life.
No. And somewhat like David Strauss, a German theologian who had earlier written a Life of Jesus, Renan makes the controversial assertions that the life of Jesus should be written like the life of any other man, that the Bible should be subject to the same critical scrutiny as other historical documents, which, of course, is what's happened in biblical scholarship since the time of people like Renan. We'll look at Reichel and Renan and Strauss and Schleiermacher, whom we've also mentioned in later sessions. The Encyclopedia concludes its evaluation of Kant by saying, "Some philosophers and theologians have held that the objective data on which the Catholic religion is based are incapable of proof from speculative reason, but are demonstrable from practical reason, a will, sentiment, or vital action." Of course, it's referring to Kant here. "That this position is, however, dangerous is proved by recent events. The immanentist movement, the vitalism of Blondel," they're talking about here Maurice Blondel, a Catholic philosopher of the late 19th, early 20th century, "the anti-scholasticism of the annals of Christian philosophy, and other recent tendencies toward a non-intellectual apologetics of the faith have their roots in Kantism, and the condemnation they have received from ecclesiastical authority shows plainly that they have no clear title to be considered a substitute for the intellectualistic apologetic which has for its ground the realism of the scholastics." This was written, what I was just quoting there, was written all around 1910 in the midst of the modernist crisis in the church. And we'll examine that later, what it boils down to. If we can't reach God through the senses and the intellect, perhaps we can reach him through intuition or conscience or feelings or emotions or experience or some other such internal mechanism or faculty of the soul. Although he didn't refer to Kant by name in his encyclical condemning modernism, Pascendi Dominici Gregis, I understand that Pope St. Pius X had Kant as well as a few others in mind when he wrote this document. "Regarding this matter, the Pope laments that the fact that, quote, natural theology, the motives of credibility, and external revelation are all rendered impotent in the modernist system. If man cannot know truth, it is the end of all revelation and consequently of all religion. By agnosticism, every avenue that leads to God is barred." Remember, we had told how Kant to close the door and put up a barrier to reaching God directly. That is, his philosophy did. We'll take a look at both Protestant and Catholic modernism and its effects on biblical scholarship in later sessions. But what they're referring to here in the encyclopedia is, when you talk about, natural theology, we're talking about, as St. Paul had urged us, to look at God's beautiful nature, and then we can reason from that to God's existence, and not only that, but some of his attributes. And at the same time, we can also, because we're created in God's image and likeness, we can look at the human soul and reason from that to something about, in an analogical sense, to something to God's existence and something of God's attributes. By the motives of credibility, we spent a whole 47, I think, or at least 40 half-hour sessions in Reasons to Believe, looking at motives of credibility. That is, reasons to believe.
How reason itself, yes, could lead us up to faith.
Yes, and what, of course, the Pope is saying here, as Pope Pius, St. Pius X, is that Kant's philosophy completely renders all of these inoperable. Well, we spent a lot of time on Immanuel Kant because I believe that we simply can't understand how most people think today without a knowledge of his thought. This is especially true of understanding many, if not most, theologians and biblical scholars, especially those today. Now, this doesn't mean that all of these people know and understand Kant's philosophy. In fact, hardly anybody does. But it has permeated the culture so deeply that it is the way most people, most of them unknowingly think. To quote the famous realist philosopher Alfred North Whitehead again, in regard to Kant's philosophy, and this is quite a famous quote here, quote, "It has held its own," he's talking about Kant's philosophy now, "it has held its own as the guiding principle of scientific studies ever since." And by scientific studies, we're talking about, you know, biblical studies as well, because biblical scholars, at least they think, they're employing the scientific method. Now, later on, we'll get into analysis of that in some later sessions and see just how, to what degree they really do that. But it is still reigning, going back to Whitehead. "Every university in the world organizes itself in accordance with it. No alternative system of organizing the pursuit of scientific truth has been suggested. It is not only reigning, but it is without a rival. Yet it is quite unbelievable," end of quote. I believe that the roots of modern skepticism, materialism, scientism, pragmatism, subjectivism, and relativism are to be found in Kant's philosophy. And I think lots of other people believe that too. I part mostly believe that because other people who know a whole lot more about the subjects than I do believe that. And their reasoning sounds very logical to me. Our Pope Benedict XVI believes that relativism is the greatest challenge that our world faces today, what he calls the dictatorship of relativism.
Okay, before we go on to the 19th century, can you give us a brief summary in a minute we've got, what we've said about the 18th century?
I think we probably ought to reserve that for at least one session, because we've done so much in the last 5 or 6, 7 or 8 sessions dealing with the Enlightenment and that whole period of the 18th century, because it was such a seminal period that let's just save a whole session for that.
All right, makes good sense. To our listening audience, we say thank you for listening, and may God bless you always and in all ways.